Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome to A Republic If You Can Keep It. I'm Jeff Timmer. This has been another week filled with many, many major political stories here in Michigan, Mark, and you know, you're directly involved in some of them. Let's start with redistricting. There's three lawsuits in different courts and involving some different issues. So why don't we kind of run through those, maybe starting with the Voting Rights Act lawsuit in the state Supreme Court.
All right. Well, thanks, Jeff. Yeah, it's been a busy week on the legal front and other fronts that we'll talk about. In redistricting this week, we saw the Supreme Court dismiss the Voting Rights Act complaint by a 4-3 vote. It was very interesting. It was a bipartisan vote, actually. Three Democrats and a Republican justice in the majority, two Republicans and a Democratic justice in the minority. And what the majority said was basically, look, they didn't bring us enough proof initially. I mean, in a Voting Rights Act case, you have to make an initial demonstration that there is sufficient African-American population concentrated, voting is polarized, et cetera, to demonstrate that there's an obligation to draw majority-minority districts. And the plaintiffs didn't do that. And that's what the majority said. The dissenters took an interesting approach. They didn't necessarily agree with the plaintiffs, but they said, look, let's give them some more time. Let's you know, get some more evidence. Let's do some discovery, as they call it, and see if they can come up with the evidence to make this work. You know, again, that was not persuasive to the other four justices. And so that case was dismissed this week. We'll see if there's any other Voting Rights Act cases filed, but that case is now gone. But there are two other cases, as you indicated. There are some interesting developments in the federal court case this week. This is a case brought by Republican activists in federal court in Western Michigan. They're currently judge shopping. And they drew the Republican president appointed Chief Judge Paul Maloney there. And then to complete the three-judge panel, because you get three judges in these redistricting cases, one of the other staunch conservative judges from the Sixth Circuit, Ray Kethledge, got appointed. And another person who, although she was nominated by a Republican president, has a Democratic background, Janet Neff, who's now basically a senior judge on the court. So there's that development this week. There are, frankly, two strong ideological conservatives on that panel. But the Democrats finally awakened this week, and a group of Democratic activists have asked to intervene in the case. And they've also want to dismiss one of the claims. There's a claim in there that somehow county breaks violate the federal constitution. Very strange, very weak. But they've asked the court to dismiss that and let them participate in the lawsuit. So we'll see how that all plays out now that we have three judges, Democrats seeking to intervene to represent their interests. Strangely, there's been no effort by anybody to say to the federal court, this really does belong in state court under United States Supreme Court precedent. But there it sits. And there's a real risk here of, you know, there could be contradictory results if somebody were to bring another case about the congressional delegation in the Michigan Supreme Court. You could end up with two different maps. And so that's one of the reasons why the U.S. Supreme Court over the course of time has said, look, state court should handle this in the first instance, and federal court should just be a backup. Finally, I represent a group of clients led by the League of Women Voters who filed suit in the Michigan Supreme Court this week over the state house map, claiming that there's a lack of partisan fairness. The commission's own analyst indicated that all the measures of partisan fairness she used leaned Republican, more than leaned Republican. They were Republican across the board. Our own expert, we hired an independent expert who's done a lot of this work around the country, including in the Michigan redistricting trial that you and I participated in a couple of years ago, he reached the same conclusion. And the way that that map is drawn, Republicans could win a majority of the state house with a minority of the statewide vote, and vice versa for Democrats, that they could win a majority of the statewide vote, but not win a majority of the seats. That's a classic definition of partisan unfairness. And we know from the alternative maps submitted by Promote the Vote and other measures that it is possible to make that map much fairer than it is. And so that's what my clients and I have asked for. The commission has a week to respond, so we'll get a response from them middle of next week, and then we will see what the Supreme Court decides to do. Their practice in the Voting Rights Act case was to let both sides have oral argument so the court can ask questions and explore the issues and then make a decision. So we'll see. And the court has been very good about treating these matters very promptly, which is in everybody's interest. So we'll see what comes there. So the pot continues to boil on redistricting. And just one last note for our listeners, there's no time limit on bringing these lawsuits. In the old legal regime, there was a 60-day time limit. That is gone. Obviously, the clock's ticking toward the filing deadline, and the court will take those kinds of things into account. But again, there's really no deadline for these kind of suits to be filed, either in state court or federal court. I think it's even conceivable that after we have an election under these new maps, a lawsuit could be filed in 2023 if there's evidence of some violation. So, you know, we continue to, you know, play out this new system that the voters adopted in 2018. Sorry for the long-winded answer, Jeff, but there's a lot going on.
You have such an interesting and unique perspective when it comes to your role in this and your experience in this that I think that that's of great benefit to our listeners. I've been known to dabble in redistricting myself from time to time, you know, once a decade or so over the last three or four decades. And I, you know, from my perspective, and, you know, I'll stake my membership before the bar in this, and, you know, I don't have one, so I can say that. From the federal case, with it seems since the commission drew these districts without precisely equal population, that has always seemed a flaw. There's historical precedent in other states for that, but it seems like they just never paid attention to the fact that since 1972, Michigan has had precisely equal congressional districts, and that never seemed to enter their consideration. They have small deviations of several hundred people. I mean, it's a rounding error when you're talking about districts of 750,000, but nonetheless, it seems a sloppy error, and it's one that you could leave 99.9% of the plan intact and achieve that population equality between the districts. That would be it would almost be a de minimis kind of fix, similar to crossing the T's and fixing typos in a piece of legislation, almost to fix those populations.
That's right, Jeff. I mean, somebody like you who's so expert in drawing maps, you could probably fix those maps in 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was careless by the commission to do that. But what they've now done, that has opened the door to this lawsuit. And it's interesting, the Republicans attached a map. They didn't give any data, but you can look at the map and see it's a Republican gerrymander. There may well be as few as four Democratic seats under the map they want that federal court to adopt. So back to their own tricks. We'll just have to see how this all plays out in federal court. But I want to put some things back on your plate, because this week the ballot proposals continue to roll out. There were three filed just this week. In all my years in politics, I've never seen so many proposals out there. I'll just rattle them off, Jeff, and I want to get your reaction to them. Today, I mean, as we record here at 5 o'clock on Friday, a petition that says we're now going to use ranked choice voting in all state and federal elections was introduced, and they want to go forward with that. What are your thoughts, Jeff? You and I haven't talked about this since we did a couple of interviews several months ago about ranked choice voting. What do you think about that as a concept and particularly applied here in Michigan?
We had somebody involved with ranked choice voting effort in Michigan, and they were very earnest and sincere in their desire to make the election process simpler, easier, come up with a majority of votes as opposed to pluralities that exist in several of our elections. It seems to me that it's a bridge too far, that it's a concept that hasn't been tested thoroughly enough around the country. To me, there's a lot of problems, a lot of things that need to be fixed and addressed in our election system. How we conduct this simple act of voting and choosing who we vote for isn't one of them. I think first the priority ought to be with protecting the right of all eligible voters to be able to vote, to be able to make voting simpler, as we did in 2018 and in 2020, as we saw with the hugely increased participation in our election. We saw historic numbers of people turn out in 2018, historic numbers in 2020, even with the pandemic, voting absentee, voting by mail. Those are the kinds of the things I would rather look at. I think ranked choice voting to me right now feels like a solution in search of a problem that we don't have. That's my initial take on it. There's other fixes that I think our election system needs. And out of the top 10 things I do to change the system, that would be number 12.
Well, interesting that you should say that, because another of the big petitions filed this week was a voting rights constitutional amendment, which would build on what Promote the Vote did back in 2018 with Proposal 3, which is the source of the success you just talked about, expanded AV voting, et cetera. But this would touch a lot of things you talked about. So I want to get your reaction to some of these elements in that ballot proposal. First of all, 9 days of early in-person voting. So this is not absentee voting. This is where you could go to a physical location and cast a ballot. And this is very popular in other states. And in other states, they often do things called voting centers, where a number of municipalities kind of join together. People go to a central place. So what do you think about the concept of early voting in person prior to Election Day?
I've become a believer in it. I think that that's it's something that's been in place for several election cycles in a number of states, red states and blue states and purple states. It's been shown to make participation that much easier for those who are eligible to vote. And it's been shown to be safe and secure, and it hasn't done anything there are states where Republicans have controlled the process for a long time. They favor it in those states. Democrats favor it in blue states where they have it. I think that there's enough evidence. There's enough trial data out there. It's been tested. It's been battle tested, and that's something I think is safe. One question, just as you say that, is it allows for 9 days of early voting. Does it require 9 days of early voting? Are all clerks required to make voting available during the 9 days prior, or will we see a lack of uniformity potentially when it comes to that around the state?
It does require it, there could be more that is offered. For example, that was a feature that we saw back in 2018 with Proposal 3, that it set a floor for making, access to AV ballots available and those kinds of things. But, people could provide more, clerks could provide more access. There's some other interesting aspects of this. There's been controversy about drop boxes and efforts. We've seen legislative efforts to try to cut back. This proposed constitutional amendment would basically guarantee the right to drop boxes, a certain number per population, make sure that they are accessible, equally across the municipality. So I think those are very popular with voters last cycle. Additional assurances that election audits are going to be done by public officials, so we don't get these Arizona-style audits done by private contractors funded with unknown money and all the, you know, mischief that that could create.
What about people who do TV pillow infomercials? They seem to be experts in voting. I mean, are they going to be allowed to do audits?
Not under this proposal.
No, I see. I don't know. That's
it. Yeah, no, I think, you know, again, trying to protect the integrity of the system in terms of what's going on there. And there is a very comprehensive part of this proposal, which creates a fundamental right to vote in the state constitution. In the text of the Constitution, there's case law that recognizes a fundamental right to vote. But then it goes on to talk about no intimidation, no harassment, you know, no use of whatever kind of mechanisms there may be to try to suppress the vote. And I think that could be a very powerful tool going forward to try to head off some of these voter suppression tactics that we've got. I mean, it's a very comprehensive proposal. I think will be quite popular with the voters once they come to understand what's in it.
No, I've been reading about this and watching it and talking to people this week, and I think it's what's needed in Michigan right now, and then quite honestly, this kind of concept in other states that allow initiative and referendum. I hope that Michigan can become the model for these other states because, you know. In my view, there's no question that voting rights are under direct and sustained assault from one political party. The Republicans have decided they cannot win elections if all the eligible voters are able to participate. And so they're trying to limit, as a campaign tactic, they're trying to limit who can participate in voting. We're seeing that here in Michigan with their Secure MI Vote, Jim Crow 2.0. We've never had Jim Crow precisely in Michigan, and they're trying to bring that here. And I think that this is a great way to ensure that Michigan elections continue to see robust participation. And there was a time when both political parties tried to engage in the field of ideas and convince more people to vote for them. One party's given up on that. And someday maybe we'll see center right candidates again try to attract a majority of votes rather than manipulate the voting pool.
Yeah. You made a good point earlier. A number of these reforms are used elsewhere in the country. They're very popular in Democratic-controlled states and Republican-controlled states. So there really is bipartisan support across the country for these reforms. And I think they will make a big difference. Now, you know, you and I have talked a lot about this over the last year, you know, the threats to the right to vote. We'll see. We may not get anything out of the federal government. So each state is now kind of on its own to try to do these kinds of things. And I think this will be a great step forward if the voters will embrace this. So, Jeff, it's also, I think, important for our listeners to understand the incredibly broad coalition that is behind this. You know, Promote the Vote, the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, the NAACP, Voters Not Politicians. I mean, basically every major and not so major reform group in the state is behind this. So there's an enormous amount of energy and talent and resources, volunteer base of E&P. Time is short. I mean, they've only got till July 11th to gather probably at least 500,000 to 600,000 signatures. But I think that group is perfectly capable of pulling that off.
Yes, we know from having been involved in these petition drives on various issues over decades, anybody can start a petition drive. It doesn't take much. Not everybody can succeed in getting those petitions, getting the sufficient number of signatures to get onto the ballot. It takes organization and it takes money. And very few groups, even though there's a record number of petitions out there right now, I'm still suspect that many of them will ever be anything more than ideas. That a small, out of this large number, they're not all going to be on the ballot. And so it's this is one, I don't think there's any question that that this issue will be on the ballot. This constitutional amendment will be before the voters in November.
Well, there's a big subset of these, Jeff, that you're right, aren't going to be on the ballot because the sponsors don't want them on the ballot. And that's the voucher proposals, the audit proposal, so-called Secure My Vote, which is a voter suppression piece, Unlock Michigan 2. So, you know, there's no intention by those sponsors to get on the ballot. they want to get enough signatures so the legislature can adopt it and Governor Whitmer can't veto it. We've never seen the use of that device on this scale in the past. I mean, we've seen maybe one or two petition drives. This is something started by Right to Life back in the 80s. But now we've got almost half a dozen proposals whose sole purpose is to bypass the governor and have the legislature adopt them. I think at some point, very soon, there's going to be a reaction to that loophole in the Constitution and an effort to try to eliminate it and say, look, if you want to go to the ballot, go to the ballot. And we can't have this detour through the legislature in which a small minority of the voters can end up getting their public policy enacted without the full democratic with a small D process coming into play.
No, I agree. And I've used that loophole to the advantage of people I've worked with and worked for in the past. It is legal in Michigan. It has been done a handful of times. People have now recognized how easy it is to, with in the scheme of things, a relatively small amount of money when it comes to the amount of money that goes into lobbying in to pass issues in Michigan, to manipulate the system, within the confines of the Constitution and within the confines of the law. But it exposes, I think, a glaring weakness in the intent of the delegates at the convention 60 years ago, the state, constitutional convention that allowed for the direct democracy, the ballot initiatives that a small number, and we're talking 5-8%, 5% in a referendum, 8% of in a legislative initiative, a small number of signatures with a willing legislature in an agreement ahead of time to do this can hijack the system in a way that I don't think anybody foresaw back when they allowed for that to happen. They didn't recognize how this would become effectively weaponized nearly 60 years later.
Right, and the two voucher proposals are being funded by the DeVosses directly and through a variety of conduits from around the country. And I think the rest of these proposals hope to ride piggyback on those efforts, right? I mean, you and I both know people like to circulate multiple petitions. You pay them to circulate a couple, and you can cobble enough money together to try to get the other ones as part of a package. So it's going to be a very interesting spring when the weather starts to break and maybe the pandemic relaxes a little bit. There's going to be a lot of competition for signatures out there. And I think it's going to get quite expensive for all of these groups, no matter which side of the aisle they're on, to pull off these petition drives in the next few months.
More on This Week in Michigan Politics from Mark and Jeff after these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
So, Jeff, other big developments this week. We continue to see developments out of the January 6th committee, memos coming out about using the NSA, using the HHS, using the military to seize voting machines. But we also see now that these fake electors, these Republicans in Michigan and other states who claimed they were legitimately elected, now seem to be in the crosshairs of some prosecutors. What's your take on all that?
Well, you know, after a year of listening to the Republicans scream about fictional voting fraud, it's kind of ironic that they're exposed as having engaged in actual election fraud. They signed these documents. This was part of a nationwide conspiracy in seven states to gum up the works, to throw a wrench in the gears of the certification of the elections in these states, of the slates of electors that were submitted to Congress in hopes of either giving Trump a majority or denying Biden a majority, even though he had legitimately won the election, so that it could either to prevent Biden from getting the White House, to maybe throw it to the House of Representatives, where Republicans controlled 26 of the state delegations, and the votes are awarded state by state. So Trump would have been reelected president, even though he had clearly lost the election. It is the classic definition of a coup. These people in the states, and I know most of the people on the list in Michigan, the Republican fraudulent electors, and they might have been useful idiots, but that doesn't negate them of participating in a crime. The prosecutors at the federal level, and if the state investigators are going to be involved, are going to be looking at who's behind the conspiracy. Where did the orders come from? Where was the legal research being done? Who was giving them these forms and making sure that this was all coordinated across the states? And when that all traces back to the RNC and to the Trump White House and the Trump campaign and Trump himself, that's the ultimate what they're looking for. They don't care about the volunteers in Michigan, many of whom were being, they thought, loyal foot soldiers to the party. Here, sign this. Never dawned on them that they were committing a crime, I'm sure, in many of the instances. Some of them might have known. Some of them were, more involved. I'm sure. I thought it was interesting that the January 6th committee, they subpoenaed the national committee woman and another vice chair of the Michigan Republican Party who were had signed these documents. They were listed as the chairperson and secretary of the Electoral College delegation. So they had official officer roles. And so that's who they've subpoenaed. A couple of people have asked me, why do you think Michigan Republican Party co-chair Michonne Maddock wasn't subpoenaed? She seems to be at the center of all this. And I'm thinking, oftentimes the targets of investigations aren't subpoenaed until they're indicted. So we'll have to see where this goes. As the evidence comes out, and over the last year, it has continued to mount, these executive order drafts that were from the White House ready to be implemented to use any number of federal officers or military to seize voting equipments, to seize ballots, to create that kind of situation, chaos in the system, where they wanted the Republican controlled legislatures in these states to then intervene and submit say that these Republican slates of electors, even though they weren't legitimately elected, we now think that they are. That's what they were trying to do. It's the classic definition of a coup. It was an attempt to take over the United States government. In most years before, this would have been big news. But, this week people were more focused on Tom Brady and Jim Harbaugh in the Michigan news, it seems like, than some of this. I think it's an imperative that we just continue to sound the alarm. I think it's great that there's some really good investigatory work being done by some political reporters here in the state and nationally on this. It's a story that no matter how much the Republicans want to downplay it and make it go away, they're not going to be able to escape this. And it's going to end up being an indictment on the entire party, the entire Trump apparatus. And ultimately, I think we're going to see some high-level indictments and trials trials, maybe right up to and including Trump himself.
Yeah, I must tell you, Jeff, when I was I watched the Republican fake electors show up at the Capitol, you know, in the middle of December in 2020, I thought, well, you know, I believe in free speech. This is just kind of a symbolic protest. Okay. But it's not very clear that that was part of an organized effort to have all these electors from all these battleground states send in these fake certificates and give Pence and the state legislatures, as you've indicated, a reason to refuse to certify, create chaos, and try to stir things up enough so that the certification of Biden could not succeed. So, again, what appeared to be a kind of disorganized stunt was, in fact, just, you know, the tip of the iceberg in terms of all the organized activity that we have seen. We continue to see references to what happened up in Antrim County, how that was parlayed, you know, cited by the president, given to the Justice Department as some kind of proof and evidence that there was national voter fraud, and the Justice Department and the military and all these other folks had to be involved. I mean, and we read about these meetings at the, was it the Willard Hotel, where they were kind of had like a war room for several weeks where they were doing all this planning of what would happen around the country and what would happen in Washington up to January 6th and even beyond. So, again, it's just remarkable to, you know, see, I think the other thing, though, too, I think, Jeff, people are just numb at this point to all of this. But you're perfectly, you're absolutely accurate that we can't be numb to it. This was, you know, this was actual. This was, they were trying to pull this off. And I think it's just a dry run for what we may see in the future. These folks are not going to be deterred. And we could see this kind of attempt in 2024 if Trump runs again.
Yeah, and we saw today the Republican National Committee meeting in Salt Lake City, Utah, unanimously censured Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for their participation in the January 6th committee. Their crime was is trying to get to the bottom, the truth about what happened. And what I think history is going to show is one of the worst episodes in American history, where the attempt to actually destroy American democracy, the Constitution, the rule of law was fomented directly from the White House in an effort to stay unlawfully in power. And the Republican National Committee today indicated they are nothing more than an organized crime group now. That's they would, anybody who opposes the family is going to pay the price. You know, Kinzinger and Cheney are now like Fredo out in the boat on Lake Tahoe as far as the Republicans are concerned, and that shows that the party has lost any claim to a moral compass and ideology. They are nothing but a group that protects and tries to absolve and gain power regardless of whether or not they win elections.
Yeah, as I understand it, and you're the expert on this, that the effect of that vote today means now that national Republican Party resources can be deployed in a primary against Liz Cheney. And otherwise, it would not be possible. But that was one of the purposes of this vote today, that, you know, she's going to now face the onslaught of the official party organization and all of its resources in her attempt to get through the Republican primary in Wyoming. Do I read that right? Is that accurate?
That was one of the reasons why they've done this, is to give them the means within the party bylaws to oppose a sitting member of Congress seeking reelection. And so they do have the ability to direct party resources into Wyoming against Liz Cheney. Now, fortunately for Cheney, it's Wyoming. You could probably, for the amount of money that's going to be spent on both sides in her primary, you could probably buy all the TV stations in Wyoming. You could probably buy cars for every, you know, man, woman, and child in the state. It's almost impossible to spend the kind of money in Wyoming that people are going to try to spend in Wyoming. But it is going to be a symbolic battle of just right versus wrong. That's what is set up here. There's a clear white hat and there is a clear black hat, and that's the battle here. It's not just for the soul of the Republican Party. It's an indication of the future of the soul of American politics. politics. And if the whether or not Liz Cheney remains in Congress, I think is kind of beside the point. If she can win and thwart this effort and beat Trump and the entire Republican machine from across the country, that sends a pretty bold message. If they're able to topple her in a party primary that, you know, maybe 75,000 people are going to vote in. I mean, that's the number of people who vote a statewide primary in Wyoming. They're not going to take away her voice, her microphone, and she's going to become like this Obi-Wan figure. If they strike her down, she's going to become more powerful than they can ever imagine.
Let me take you, Jeff, if I can, from Wyoming to Florida. We saw this week in Republican Attorney General candidate Matt DiPerno's campaign finance report that he's apparently fixing to hold a fundraiser with Donald Trump down at Mar-a-Lago. What do you read into the significance of that?
Trump has endorsed DiPerno on three different, he sent out three different statements over the past several months, endorsing DiPerno and reaffirming his endorsement. And so much of the political press in Michigan, especially, is failing to recognize how fundamentally the dynamics of that race in those races for statewide office in Michigan that are decided by that will be decided at the Republican convention, not in a statewide primary, but at a convention of about 2,000 precinct delegates. They have failed to fundamentally understand how the level of crazy that exists is beyond anything they can comprehend. That matters more than anything. The fact that he's raising money with Trump, Matt DiPerno will have more than ample resources to win the endorsement convention and win the nominating convention, and he'll be the Republican nominee for attorney general. Many of them are still trying to pretend otherwise. They recognize that he is a fatally flawed candidate in November, and they've deluded themselves into thinking their other fatally flawed candidate, the former speaker who lost the election to Dana Nessel in 2018, is somehow less fatally flawed, but he's still fatally flawed. And they think he can somehow get through the convention, but he can't. And the only way he could possibly conceivably get through the election is to out crazy DiPerno, which would make him even more unelectable in November. So what we're seeing is there's stories that the national press loves to write about. Oh, Trump's influence is waning, and they cite some poll somewhere to show that, you know, a declining number of people want Trump to be the nominee. Well, all the evidence shows that Trump's power is stronger than it ever has been within Republican primaries, within Republican conventions. Everybody is trying to suck up to Trump. Trump is able to exert a tremendous amount of influence in races down to the very small level that presidents before Trump never even knew existed. They didn't get involved in legislative primaries backing Mike Detmer, who wants guns at all the precinct locations. He's running against a sitting state senator. Trump is involved in races like that. And what the show is that for all their crazy, and there's an ample amount of it on the Republican side, and especially within Trump's orbit, they are committed and they're focused on getting people in place who will give them the ability to do in 2024 that they lacked in 2020. And that's steal the election, whether or not they win it. And that's what their intent is. They do not want to see, they're not going to allow a repeat of 2020, even when they lose the vote in 2024. And that's what all this is about.
Well, it's so interesting because as you talked about, you know, DiPerno's work, you know, Tom Leonard is now firmly ensnared in the Chatfield scandal. In terms of the money, there was a report today, and I it's hard to believe, that Chatfield was moving money through a PAC called the BABE PAC. I kid you not, that's the acronym of the PAC, the BABE PAC, using it, looks like, as a conduit to move money into the House Republican Campaign Committee, but also to give money to Tom Leonard. And so it just, you know, it just keeps spreading, this whole scandal involving them. And, you know, I don't know how the current speaker can possibly resist much longer a thorough internal House investigation. I mean, everybody in the House on the Republican side, including staff, are caught up in all of this. And what we see is the speaker just basically stonewalling and saying, well, because there's a criminal investigation going on, we can't do anything. Well, that excuse didn't stop them from tossing Corser and Gamrat out. You know, they acted with alacrity when that happened. But now I think they're really stuck as these press reports continue to come out about, you know, Chatfield's abuses of the tax laws and the campaign finance laws and everything else. And you just can't, it's just not believable that that stopped at the door of the House, that there weren't abuses of House resources. You know, he had people on his staff were running campaign business out of the speaker's office, apparently, from what it looks like. And certainly they were parlaying their work for the speaker into a very lucrative side business, which is a whole other scandal unto itself. We got a lot of that in Lansing. So, yeah, we're out of time for today, but, you know, we could have talked just a whole hour about Chatfield's scandal today as the press continues to dig. But we'll touch on that, I'm sure, in the future.
Sure. Who would have ever thought with the reputations that Lee Chatfield and Tom Leonard had that they'd end up involved in this, you know, wild, salacious sex, drugs and rock and roll scandal, you know, with financial crimes. It's going to keep unfolding. I think this has just been the tip of the iceberg, and the collateral damage, the fallout is going right now. It probably touches every single member of the Michigan Representatives. All of these people have taken money from Tom Leonard or Lee Chatfield's committees, and these committees are now implicated directly at the center of this massive financial scandal. And there's a federal angle to this as well as state criminal angle to this. And so it is just beginning, and I would not want to be anywhere near it. And if I was giving money to candidates, I certainly wouldn't be giving it to an attorney general candidate who may be in the middle of a ginormous financial scandal.
And with that, we come to the end of this week's podcast.
If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
And despite all the things we've talked about today, if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. See you next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.